Hello and welcome to the Open Talent Report. This is the podcast where we discuss the emerging trends in labor law, employment law, independent work, and the gig economy, which many organizations are wrestling with due to the growth of the open talent and gig economy. I'm your host, Conor Heaney. When I'm not presenting the podcast, I'm the MD at CXC Global, EMEA, which compliantly connects talent and opportunity.
Hello and welcome to this week's show. I'm delighted to welcome as our guest, Steve Rader, who is the program manager at NASA Tournament Lab and the Center Excellence for Collaboration and Innovation. I got to know Steve over the course of the last year through our mutual work at Open Assembly and the Center for Transformation of Work. Steve, I think it's fair to say we're honored and delighted to have you on the show. How are you doing, my friend?
Oh, I'm doing great. Thank you for having me. This is I love this, what you guys talk about, and I'm really excited on this topic.
Hey, well, Steve, a warm welcome, and we can't wait to get into it. So, Steve, for the benefit of our audience, I feel that you've got a really fascinating career tale to tell our audience. I've never, until I met you, full disclosure, ever spoken to anyone from NASA. Of course, I watched as a child in the 1980s, the very successful missions that took place, and how you know, watching from afar in a country like Ireland, how awesome and inspiring NASA is as an organization and what NASA has achieved through its people, its technology, its processes. But Steve, what was your journey to get to NASA, if you wouldn't mind sharing with our audience?
Oh, sure. I went to university in Houston at Rice University, and I studied mechanical engineering. I enjoyed mechanical engineering. I thought it was something that was of interest, but I really didn't know what I wanted to do. But like you, I actually, my childhood was spent largely playing with rockets and dressing up as an astronaut, and that was very much part of my dream. But as I got to the end of university, it really wasn't on my radar for jobs, because I really felt that NASA only hired PhDs and world's experts, and so I didn't even think to go look. And they actually came onto the campus one day and were doing job interviews, and I spoke with one of the folks at NASA, and it was the first time I realized that, oh, NASA has, you know, engineers and lawyers and people in procurement and a whole host of folks that help make that enterprise run, and that there were more opportunities than I had anticipated. And so I put in my job application, and I ended up working initially for a contractor called Barrios Technology as a flight controller for environmental control and life support systems for a space station that actually never got built. It was called Space Station Freedom. It was the precursor to the International Space Station, and started at Johnson Space Center in 1989, working on that. When that transitioned to International Space Station, I was still working that job and working kind of the operations design facets, and had done that for a few years and became really kind of interested in software. I was kind of the go-to software person in the group, which was odd because in university I didn't like software at all. But it ended up, I was kind of drawn to it. And so I transferred to the engineering directorate within NASA and took a civil servant job and became part of the civil service here and became a software engineer and worked on communication software. My software actually transferred some of the first files up to the space shuttle, and actually did one of the very first video teleconferences with anyone in space. Wow. With some software that we put together. And so, yeah, I've kind of done various things around the agencies, including communications architectures, command and control systems, analog missions. And about 8, almost 9 years ago, I read Jeff Howe's book on crowdsourcing and realized, oh my gosh, everything has changed. And about that time, NASA was standing up an open innovation office, and they were actually a couple of years into it. and had a job opening, and I went to work for them as the deputy manager there, and have worked there ever since. And just this last summer became the program manager, and it is a really interesting area, and we're trying to kind of steer the agency into using a whole new set of tools.
And Steve, I don't think I've ever asked this before, but seeing it's you and seeing it's NASA, how awe-inspiring was it going into Johnson Space Center or wherever you first began your first day at NASA? Like, was it mind-blowing or was it intimidating? Were you proud? What was your feelings?
Oh, yeah. Well, it was kind of surreal, right? I mean, and in fact, in my first job, I ended up working under Gene Kranz. He was actually the acting division chief for what we're doing, because he was the head of all of mission operations, but actually was really interested in the space station work and came and kind of helped mentor a bunch of us. And so every week I had to present to Gene Kranz, who, you know, as you know, is the legendary flight director for Apollo 13 and several other missions. It was surreal in many ways.
Wow. And Steve, this is going to be an interesting show, I can tell. And Steve, within your current role, then, I know NASA are solving multiple problems, I suppose, at an organizational and goal level, but specifically within your program and your unit and within your lab, if you like, what set of challenges and problems are you seeking to address and solve?
Yeah, well, just a little bit of background of what our organization is. This Center of Excellence was stood up in 2011, and it actually was set up to work not just across all 10 NASA centers and across the agency, but actually across the entire federal government to help projects and programs learn how to use open innovation and crowdsourcing. And that mission has made it a really interesting challenge for our group, because we're kind of brokers of a methodology, right? And what we found is this new kind of technique of using crowd platforms to get work done and to make advances and find technologies and find innovative solutions, that technique is new to everyone, and it's hard for anyone to change kind of their tool set. And so initially when NASA rolled this out, we actually had a lot of our scientists and engineers that rejected it. And in fact, there's a Harvard Business School case study called Houston, We Have a Problem, on the workforce kind of rejecting it. And we kind of took a step back and said, well, this kind of makes sense, because if you're working at NASA, you have the feeling that you were hired to innovate. And when you get into the job, you realize that your opportunities to innovate are actually limited, because a lot of times you're just producing, right? And so you kind of innovate at the front end a lot of times, and then you're kind of working on either operating a spacecraft or actually trying to get it launched. And so what we were doing was telling our employees, hey, we want to take the most fun and rewarding part of your job that you barely ever get an opportunity to do, and we want to hand that to random strangers out in the world to go solve. And you know, that kind of falls flat. And so we reworked our messaging, and we said, look, this is not to replace your innovation that you get to do, but rather, the world has become so fast-paced and so complex in its technologies that you need better tools to find the starting point for your innovation. And so we talk about open innovation as a way to find the technologies and ideas and concepts that might live in other industries so that you have the best starting point. Because innovation is only valuable in its implementation, in its realization. And that is 1% inspiration and 99% perspiration is what we say. It takes a long time to actually make that idea and that technology come together into a real solution. But the thing is, if you don't have the right starting point, if you haven't invested the right amount of money and effort and technique in that discovery process, in that inspiration, then it acts as a multiplier on the actual implementation. So that 1%, even though it's just a tiny sliver of the overall effort necessary to make something happen, matters a huge amount because it determines how effective your solution is going to be. And so that's what we started building, and I call it boiling the frog. We knew that top-down making everyone using these tools was not going to work. And so we slowly just started building, finding people willing to use the technique, helping them through that process, measuring the effects, and building a story of successes. And, you know, over time, we've been able to reach all 10 centers, to have some really great successes, to work across government in some just fabulous ways, to attack hard problems. And so the problem, you know, your question was, what is the problem you're trying to solve? Well, the problem our group is trying to solve is, how can we help our workforce to actually get better solutions and better innovations and take advantage of this huge technology explosion that's going on out there that is affecting both the technologies available and the expertise needed to go leverage that? And how do we leverage these new crowds that kind of act as a dragnet to find those solutions? How can we activate that for the benefit of our engineers and scientists so that they don't make 5% and 10% increases in performance in their systems, but rather 10x and 100x improvements? And that's what we're really trying to do. Is our problem is, how do we get the entire workforce to where they can actually live in this new world of super accelerated change and technology explosion?
Well, I feel like actually strapping on my bloody seatbelt, Steve, and going on this journey with you. I think it would be difficult not to be inspired by what you've just said. And I think we recently had Diane Finkhuizen on the show, who ran a similar program when she was at GE, maybe a couple of years back. And my goodness, when this works, Steve, and Diane and her team got this working really well, it obviously drives the benefits that you've mentioned, that adoption of new technologies, new ways of working, reducing maybe some of the more manual tasks that you might want to get rid of and improve how you go about your daily work. But in the GE case, it also drove about $6 billion in cost transformation, right? $6 billion US dollars, which when she was telling me that, I was absolutely blown away, Steve. So I think that the rationale from a hard and soft perspective for this journey around innovation and finding the right ecosystems to partner with and to work with is really for the good. And I suppose, Steve, that this brings us nicely on, I hope anyway, to what Bloomberg, The Economist magazine, the World Economic Forum have taken to describing as the labor market paradox. And in short, what they mean by that, Steve, is this. At the peak of the pandemic, around 400 million people were displaced or unemployed. That's reduced since then, thankfully. But at the same time, you have most major organizations on a global basis hiring like it's going out of fashion, right? Unfortunately, the organizations can't hire the people they need, right? So there's this horrible mismatch between loads of supply of workers, but it's the wrong sort of supply, and lots on the demand side for particular skills and tasks to be done by organizations. So my question really is twofold to you, Steve. One, why do you think this labor market paradox has occurred or arisen? That's question number one. And then number two, Steve, in your view, what can be done to solve for this particular challenge?
Oh, goodness. Well, that is a huge question that everyone is asking right now. And I will say it's not a simple answer. We've been actually watching the labor market shift for the last 4 or 5 years in really trying to understand it. One of the things we noticed when we started exploring these crowd platforms for open innovation is that many of them not only did challenges as kind of ways to innovate, but they would also have freelancers that could go work for somebody and do a task. And then that helped kind of led us to these labor platforms, these talent platforms that are out there. And what we found was that the Edelman Intelligence study that came out in 2017 showed that there's this huge shift in the workforce where they're all moving to the freelancing gig economy. And almost everyone has people in their organization that are starting to do side gigs. And there's this big shift going on that, you know, that one study actually predicted by 2027 there would be more people freelancing full-time than full-time employment and people doing that model. And that's a huge shift. And it's not just a huge shift for workers, it's a huge shift for organizations. And the conclusion I've come to is that the rate of change that we are seeing, both in technology and the skills required to actually keep up with that technology, have reached a pace now where old models for organization are breaking. So the previous model was, you know, a hierarchy with lots of divisions, and you actually had a whole strategy of recruiting and retaining talent, right? And that was how you stayed competitive. And you only had to innovate incrementally every few years because the pace of change didn't require you to innovate faster than that. Move to where we are now, and you cannot hire people fast enough to actually keep up with the rate of change of technologies and the rate of innovation needed. Because if you hire those people in the traditional method, you have to lay off people on the back end, and you still need them. The number and of technologies that you need and the complexity of those technologies has grown so that you actually need fractions of those people in some cases, and it's just a very different workspace. The other things that are going on are that the education system's not keeping up with these new skills, and so upskilling has become a huge problem. The World Economic Forum report that came out a year ago that you referred to, I think, is really telling. You know, something like, what is it, 87 million jobs going away, or 85 million jobs going away, and 97 million jobs being created. That's a huge shift. And they're predicting that 50% of all people in jobs will need to have upskilling of some sort. And the of some sort is 40% of their job on average will change. And that's going to require training that is anywhere from 1 month to 6 months, maybe more in some cases. But the traditional model, the traditional organization budgets on average of $1,000 per employee per year. That's nowhere close. And most of that's compliance, right? It's not even upskilling. And so none of the traditional organizations are ready for this. And it's automation, it's data science, it's software. And all of these new skills are not being brought to bear. And in fact, you're seeing Google and Amazon and IBM all standing up their own training and certification programs in these areas because universities aren't pumping them out fast enough. So you can literally go, I think it's Google, I think you can go take free courses and do that for 6 to 9 months and be able to take a $75,000, $80,000 job at the end of that. That's a whole new model, right? And I will say people are moving to the gig economy in some part to upskill. They know that they're not getting what they need within organizations. I asked one freelancer at Topcoder who was on a panel with me. I said, how much of your time, you know, he's kind of a lead programmer. I said, how much of your time do you spend keeping up with new technologies, new programming languages, new tools? He said 60% of his time. And I was just blown away. I was like, how do you make any money with just 40% of your time doing work? He said, oh no, because I'm in making that investment, I'm making 5 to 6 times what normal people in my country are making. And I think freelancers are getting that. The folks in the gig economy, it's not like yesterday's freelancers where, you know, you had to do all your own marketing and it was mainly people in your own locality and, you know, you ended up only doing a portion of a job that you really liked. The rest was kind of overhead. Now there are these new platforms that are matching people to the work in ways that really brings about a freedom for the worker. And honestly, I think the workers are kind of fed up with the Dilbert kind of being owned by a company. They really like the agency. They like the flexibility. And now that they have access to global markets, it's actually becoming more reliable work than companies that are laying folks off every few years. So where are the jobs going? It's really interesting. In the old world, we used to have kind of a pyramid, right, of jobs where yes. at the top we had a few high-skill workers, and I say few, proportionally fewer really high-skill work. And then at the bottom we had lots and lots of jobs for no-skill or low-skill workers, right? And what's happening is automation is eating away at that base of that pyramid so that there's, you know, new self-driving cars and automation in warehouses and all kind of eliminating those low-skill jobs. And at the same time, you're seeing the digital transformation requirements for machine learning and software that almost every company has to do in addition to automation itself, right? The jobs of creating automation. And they're growing the top of that pyramid. So we're getting this kind of inverting of the pyramid. And what's happening is the workforce is still stuck in that old pyramid because we haven't been able to upskill. So at the bottom, you have people with low skill that don't have any jobs because or a lot fewer jobs. And at the top, you've got a whole segment of work that can't get done because there aren't enough workers. So lay on top of that, the baby boomer set that's retiring at something like 10,000 people a day retiring. And you get this really weird mix of job shortage in some areas and, you know, not being able to hire people in others. You mix in the COVID piece where there's childcare shortages, and now, you know, a lot of people at the lower end of the economic spectrum can't afford childcare, and so they're turning to the gig economy. And so now you're not even able to hire some low-skill jobs. So there really is just a tornado of different cause and effects going on here, and they're multiplying each other. And so I think it is creating real uncertainty for HR departments, and they're scrambling to try to figure out how do we better utilize the resources we have? How do we move to a liquid workforce where we can pull people in from the outside? There's more and more people leaning on the gig economy. But if you think about it, we've been working in this old model for over 100 years, yeah. And it's not going to change overnight. And a lot of folks are in denial about what's happening. And it's hard to know where to turn.
Yeah, I agree, Stephen. I think you've given a really thorough analysis of the problem, the challenge, the opportunity. And I really like how you've described that inversion, right, of the market. And I think one of the great pities, if you like, and maybe that's the wrong choice of words to use around the gig and platform economy, is that you have this dichotomy. You've got the high choice, high demand knowledge workers that essentially can name their price anytime, any place, anywhere. They're mobile or they're working remote. They're geared up from a technology perspective, and clearly they're geared up from a skills and specialization and knowledge perspective. And then, as you rightly say, you've got the, as I would describe them, low choice, no choice workers that are at the bottom of that pyramid, if you like, performing gigs and tasks in the gig economy. And I'm thinking your delivery driver, your transportation, whether it's Uber or others apply, of course. And I know that some of that can be automated, but it hasn't been yet. So you've got the workers at the bottom that have essentially no choice or low choice. They got to work, right? Because all these state supports are being turned off that have allowed people, I suppose, not to work, which is it's something I'm really interested in. Actually, the unintended consequences, Steve, of the COVID supports and, you know, how that might impact the universal basic income further down the line. But I think we could probably devote a whole episode to that, actually, but we'll come back to that, Steve. But for me, this is where I'm conflicted, because I believe in the platform and open talent and gig economy. I believe, Steve, that it's a force actually for good. It allows workers to get skills in different areas and upskill and reskill. But how do we protect those people at the bottom of the pyramid, right? Should they be allowed, I suppose, to be governed by the forces of the market? Or should we put some protection around those folks and look after them? What's your thoughts, Steve?
Yeah, well, you know, in any big shift like this, right, where you're going from something that's existed for 100 years to an entirely new model, there's going to be a lot of churn and a lot of good and bad, right? I think that the gig economy offers a huge opportunity for individuals to be able to adapt quickly to changing technologies and to be able to upskill. But there's a lot there that has to change to really make that feasible for everyone. And one is our education systems. Our education systems are still front-loaded with this idea that you go to school in the first, 18 to 20 years of your life, and then you basically do that for a long time. And there's some upskilling in that model, but not a lot for lifelong. And we're moving to an era where there really needs to be lifelong learning, and we need to bring people along. And I've been really interested in kind of new techniques for that, right? Some of these labor platforms are really getting creative. There's one called Current where they train salespeople, and at each level, you're kind of doing more and more complex sales work, but you're actually doing real work and getting paid. And by the time you work your way through all the levels, you're qualified to do, a lot more valuable work, and you're getting paid more. But the actual process of being trained provides a little bit of an income, and it's this incentive that's really interesting. If you look at Paro.io, which is an accounting crowd, they actually use machine learning to match the workers to their tasks, but they do it not such that the absolute best gets assigned. Rather, they get the one that is minimally qualified to actually do that work, and then make sure that they have the supports necessary to get it done and get it done well. But by the time that accountant is finished with that work, they've actually upskilled because they've actually stretched themselves and done something new that they knew a little bit about but actually learned more about. And if you think about it, a crowd that is constantly being assigned new work and being facilitated new kinds of learning opportunities, that's where we need to see things. And I think you look at crowds like Topcoder that have big training programs for their community members. There's challenges to kind of get a chance to try out your new skills with actually no consequences if you fail. Those are some really interesting constructs. But fundamentally, to get this available to everyone, we're going to have to rework our education systems and the way we deliver those, the way we incentivize. And a lot of that's going to be how we rework organizations. They need to take on some of that upskilling. I often think of Uber drivers that are sitting waiting at the airport for, oftentimes an hour or two for in these queues. And I'm thinking Uber really missed an opportunity there because they could have been upskilling those workers that they know eventually will be automated away with self-driving cars. This is an opportunity where those folks could be upskilled to something in the information economy, in the data economy, that really could help. So the knowledge economy is the hardest thing to move folks through, but it is definitely valuable.
Yeah, I agree. And some of the call-outs there, particularly around what Topcoder are doing, I think is phenomenal, Steve. I really do. And it got me thinking, Steve, I hadn't thought to ask this, but the thought occurred to me when you were speaking. So I think what the COVID pandemic has proven is that the talent can reside anywhere, and that the world is much smaller now that you can access the talent you need. And there's this hire anyone, hire anywhere movement, and companies like CXC and others are hopefully facilitating that globally. But it struck me that there's very few frontiers left to source or acquire or work with talent. So Ukraine and Belarus has been well known, and Poland over the last maybe 3 to 10 years as a real hub for specialized developers. And it got me thinking, where is the last frontier where talent resides, and where can we level up the playing field with regards to global standards or global rates? And I was thinking that Africa is potentially a continent and location that is forgotten about from a talent pool perspective, and whether the pandemic and the trend for remote working will help propel African workers into the global workforce. Any thoughts on what is a rather random thought that's come into my head, Steve?
Yeah, well, I think you're right on. There are many labor pools still to be tapped into, and you know, this is where it is actually still early days in this whole move, and I would say that there are many countries that as they invest in infrastructure and in internet access and in education, all of these things are going to start paying dividends because the global economy is accessible now. It's open for everyone. I think countries that put in place facilitating laws and infrastructure that help folks, and you mentioned several countries that have kind of done that and kind of facilitated their folks getting online and getting that global work, is smart. I think too, there's a trust building that's got to go on. I tell people, when Uber first came out, almost everyone I know's first reaction was, there's no way I'm ever getting into some stranger's car. And the same with Airbnb, right? There's no way I'm going to go sleep in somebody else's home or bed. And yet we do that now because they built trust. And I think we're in early days of mechanisms where trust can be built and kind of brokered in digital ways with blockchain. And I know some folks at Velocity and other places are working on these very, you know, solid identities that allow people to work and not just be associated with a country, but be associated with their work and their own trust that they can build up kind of as a global citizen. It's very interesting. I think that when you talk about access to new creative labor markets, I think, especially in the innovation space where we started, that there are huge opportunities to tap into communities that have the secret of innovation, which is diversity. Over and over, yes. What we find out is more of the same folks, the same kind of folks, give you the same answers. And if you really want to see innovation hard at work, bring in diversity. And I will tell you, I did a trip to Kenya a couple of years ago, and I saw innovation everywhere. Yes. And a lot of that is just out of need, right? I would say there's other areas that are within our own populations that aren't national border restricted, but rather traditional model restricted. So neurodiversity, we're going to see a lot of people who never could have passed an interview because they didn't have the social parts of their brain work in the same way that would work in an interview, that are able to do amazing software and data science and analytics. And we're going to be able to tap into those types of folks on the labor platforms in ways that we never could have before. And it's going to really bring opportunity to a whole host of folks that through bias or through hiring mechanisms or whatever the reason, were not able to participate in previous economies. And so I'm very excited about that. And I'm excited about programs that start to do that. We very much, as you know, during OA, Open Assembly, and Center for Transformational Work, we've very much been trying to make sure that the platforms are considering, how do you make your platform more accessible to people with limited bandwidth? How do you make sure it's got the right languages? How do you make sure it's not somehow excluding folks? How do we make invite more people into the global economy so that everyone can prosper? And I think that's what's available through this model. Whereas before, you had to move somewhere, you had to actually meet certain citizenship requirements, there were all these limiters on people, and a lot of that's being stripped away.
Yeah, I agree. And Steve, speaking of limiters, right, and I'm just thinking NASA, huge government body, if you like, in the United States with huge buying power, but I would imagine quite rigid rules when it comes to working with different partners, working with different technology providers. And if we look at the new digital labor market platforms or talent marketplaces, how difficult was it for your organization to work with those talent marketplaces? I suppose that's question number one. And how did you go about building a business case to work with those type of organizations? And then two, on a general basis, do you think the talent marketplaces on a general basis have evolved their offering sufficiently for the public and private enterprise? So two questions.
That's a lot there. For us, we did not start in that realm, right? We started in open innovation, which is kind of a different model. But then what we found was these crowd platforms are the secret, right? Whether you're using challenges as your matching algorithm, or you're using a direct, personnel search using AI to find the right expert, that they're actually, it's all about matching. And when you have a crowd of hundreds of thousands, and sometimes, Freelancer, one of the ones we use is 55 million users on their platform. When you start talking about those kinds of platforms, then you can start to actually access, really almost always being able to access the cutting edge, and always being able to find interesting innovations and from other domains. So very interesting start to it. What we did is, once we noticed that, hey, there's a blurred line between open innovation and open talent, and they kind of share some of these platforms, and there is value to what they can provide, we actually innovated with some of our procurement folks, which that's probably doesn't sound like an oxymoron there, right? But it turns out our innovation and legal folks, they want to innovate as well. And they recognize that the old rules, the old interpretations don't always match. And we always have to watch what are those rules trying to do? And the rules and the processes we had were really about making sure things remained fair, and making sure that businesses and companies and individuals weren't somehow gaming the system or cheating or, doing something that was not in line with the government's values and what the government was trying to do, and legally, that we were maintaining fairness. And so with that framework, we worked with our procurement and our legal folks to come up with pieces to our latest contract, the NASA Open Innovation Services 2 contract, that included labor platforms and said, okay, crowds can do things. We're largely using what we call the procurement authority or the federal acquisition regulations. And so we said, look, we're going to ask these platforms for products, right? And whether they go and do a challenge or they go and find freelancers or put a team together, that's their model. And we're going to let them exercise that model to put together the best product that we're asking for. And that has served us really well. And I will say, for what it's worth, it has provided us a way to get our toe in the door with open labor platforms. We are still really just starting. And, when you're talking about the traditional model of full-time employees, contractor, full-time engineers, subcontractors, that ecosystem is very different, and it's going to take us a little bit to understand how we can use these folks together with these other models. How do those models need to change? And so we're looking at how can we change our contracting so that we can include this model and help the entire ecosystem adapt to this changing world, and not just NASA and civil service and the government. So it is a journey. We recognize that we're probably going to hit some legal issues, because if you think about it, the laws have all been built around a traditional model over the last 100 years that is changing. And when the very structures and the forces behind it change, then you have to actually start changing laws. And you're seeing that battle play out, right, in regulation already. You see laws about Uber in various countries and states. And it's the traditional model pushing against this new model, because not everyone understands the new model. And a lot of people are afraid of it. And if you've done full-time employment your entire life, this idea of freelancing is really scary. But if you've been laid off a bunch of times, it looks pretty appealing. And if you're a company and you're used to acquiring and retaining talent, this idea of bringing in folks feels a lot like that first Uber ride that you heard about. And you're like, there's no way I'm doing that. How can I trust that someone in the crowd can help me with my product? And I get it. We're still getting all of that, the kinks worked out of that.
Yeah, but Steve, I have to say, your approach at NASA has been very considerate, and it seems to me a case of, let's do it now and we'll work out how as we go, right? But I mean that in the best possible way. And A lot of our listeners on the show, Steve, come from the procurement community, and we've had a number of debates on the show and offline as well about talent marketplaces' place in the wider ecosystem. I happen to think that talent marketplaces are a force for the good, right? As you mentioned with freelancer.com, you got 55 million people on the platform. Like, that is a force multiplier if you're struggling to get the talent you need and you want to work in a more flexible and variable cost way of working, right? I think that's very attractive. And I think how you've outlined how you work with your procurement and legal partners to actually innovate within the NASA organization to go down this route will give our procurement and HR community listeners a lot of food for thought in the most positive way. So, Steve, thanks for taking the time actually to shine a light on that. That was really, really helpful. So thank you for that. So, Steve, we've touched on automation a couple of times in our conversation, and I wanted to discuss with you some thoughts around jobs displacement and automation. And there's an economist I've been reading quite a bit about recently, and he's referenced in Daniel Susskind's book, A World Without Work. If you haven't read it, I would urge you to read it. It's a really fascinating read on the future of work and labor, labor market economics. Who would have thought it was so interesting? But hey, listen, you're preaching to the converted. But Susskind references an economist who's since passed away called Vasily Leontief. And Leontief's hypothesis or thesis is this, Steve. About 120 years ago, the backbone of the economy, if you exclude railways, was the horse. The horse was responsible for the mass transportation of goods and people. And then about 20 years after that, the horse was essentially displaced by the combustion engine and the automobile and the truck and the tractor. And in short, Leontief's thesis is that due to automation, humans will become the new horses, right? So that's quite a dystopian view in some respects, but what's your thoughts on the thesis and the wider point of automation and jobs displacement, Steve?
Oh yeah, I love this because actually I was familiar with this because he is quoted in a video that is called Humans Need Not Apply that very much attracts us. And in it, it basically poses the questions, if you heard the statement, there will always be jobs for horses, we would kind of chuckle at that now, right? Because now there's almost no jobs for horses. And in fact, but in the turn of the century, there was no way you could imagine anything but that, right? And so when at the same time, there is a whole segment of our population that would answer the question or make the statement, there will always be jobs for humans. And what they posit in the book you're talking about, as well as the video Humans Need Not Apply, is that may not be the case. Like, there really is this trend towards taking work away. That was a really depressing time in my life when I processed all of that. but then actually I became more familiar with this new shift to the gig and new open talent models. And what I'm seeing is, if there ever was a solution to this kind of conundrum and this shift, it is actually open labor models, because it shifts to this fluidity of work that really allows for the adjustment to happen more naturally. That as the technology increases and changes, if we can get those upskilling processes going, if we can get that kind of lifelong learning going, then you'll see that there always is more jobs. In fact, that's what the World Economic Forum report says, is yes, there's 85 million jobs going away, but there's 97 million jobs being added. I may get those numbers slightly wrong, but there were more jobs being added. And I think that happens over and over. As we automate, we don't actually do less. What I use a lot of times is an analogy in the film industry. Back in the early 1900s, the first kind of motion picture animation was Snow White, and Disney produced that, right? they did that with something like 275 animators that hand painted and drew over a million, maybe even 2 million frames. And if you talk to people today, you know, our modern graphics tools are so much better, right? That probably could be done with 10 people today, right? And so in theory, our animation should be these tiny teams, and there'd be all these graphic artists that are out on the street, but that's actually not the case. If you look at Iron Man 3, which is largely animated with computer graphics, you find something like over 3,000 people in the credits. When we automate, we don't simply rest in that new, more efficient world. We do more with it. As the graphics world, speaking of graphics, as the graphics world's kind of brought the cost of graphics down, we find we have more calls for graphics because more people can afford graphics. And so I think that's what you're seeing here is the more technology takes on, the more we find out how to go use it. I could go on and on with analogies here, but I don't know that there will always be the same kind of work that we have today. I think that is very much going away. Yes. But I do think there will always be things for humans to do. And if we're going to have adaptive models where the time and money associated with tasks and the things we do changes, then this model is the way to go, right? Because it can actually kind of morph in at the individual level so that people can, you know, take on more study, learn new things, adjust their time in the workplace, balance their life. And that balance could change over time, right? Where people actually do work less and less, but for more and more money. There's going to have to be some kind of economic model if this kind of set of human tasks shrinks. But we're not quite there. And I think if we're going to have an adaptive model, this new fluid labor force model and this new kind of gig economy model is a much better model. Now, I will say, we're not there yet. No. There are things like distributed autonomous organizations, DAOs, that are blockchain-based that are now coming into view that are kind of the NFT of organizations. It blows my mind how organizations may morph and how individuals play into those is going to morph to where in just a few decades, organizations are not going to be recognizable in the same ways that we recognize them today. They're going to be much quicker in the way they stand up and shut down, right? And that's a trend that's 100 years old, right? In the 1930s, the average age of a company lifespan was something like 80, 90 years. And now it's less than 20. And so this trend is just going to keep going. And so this idea of a pop-up organization that meets a need quickly and then dissolves, I think is probably more in line with the future. And you're already seeing things like the Pizza DAO as a demo of that. And I think CTW is going to have one of the founders of that on this next week, talking about this organization that just kind of was able to assemble, raise funds, execute, and almost just go away in just a matter of weeks. And it was global in nature. It had millions of dollars associated with it. It was just a fascinating kind of glimpse into what can happen. But it's a very different model. I think IP is going to have a big shift in blockchain where there's the ability to reward people dynamically through the life of a product, right? Where you get credit for what you did, but the relative value of that's going to change over time. And you'll have this kind of income stream as those products get monetized around the world. So there's some very fascinating pieces to this that are all kind of embedded in this.
Yeah, I agree, Stephen. I really appreciate some of your insights there into what's going on. And Steve, just bring it back a moment, if we may. And we like to ask everyone this question, but over the last 12 months, what piece of technology, either hardware or software, have you utilized the most and why?
Well, over the last couple of years, it's clearly our collaboration tools, right? for us, kind of our enterprise cloud-based work, we at Johnson Space, where we shifted, and actually all across NASA shifted to Office 365 of not too long ago, and that's brought us together with a single set of tools. It's been helpful, but we use that in conjunction with G Suite, in conjunction with tools like Mural tool. You know, we use almost every flavor of video conferencing. You know, just depends on who we're talking to and who's setting up the meeting. And so we've used Google Meetup and WebEx and Zoom and all sorts of different tools there. But what's funny about that is the functionality of all of the document sharing and all of our centralized databases and all of our collaboration tools and our whiteboard, those are all starting to really interact really well and seamlessly, really regardless of which platform we use. And so, yeah, we're very much, I answered your specific technology with a whole pocket full, but I will say, digital transformation is where we're trying to get to, where we enter data once, we can access it easily, and we can start to actually collect the data for eventual AI and data analytics and all the rest of it, start taking advantage of Internet of Things. We're trying to set up for that. And so that's been an emphasis for us as well. But yeah, the collaboration tools, especially, we are now an all virtual team. We are not planning on getting back into the office. So we will remain virtual since we work across the entire agency and across the government. So it's the right set of tools at the right time.
You bet. And Steve, isn't it just amazing what organizations can achieve fully distributed and with the right technology, the right team and the right tools? And it's been a fascinating 18 months. I mean, our own organization, we were remote first in Europe over the last 6 years, right? So the adjustment for us was actually none, right? We were there already, thank goodness. That wasn't particularly for through our foresight or anything like that. It was just the best operating model for us, and it allowed us to get the right talent into our organization and of course reduce our cost base, because we don't need these huge offices in Wall Street or Canary Wharf in London or downtown Hong Kong. But Steve, I have to say, I've really, really enjoyed our conversation. I think we've touched on a number of important themes, from automation, crowdsourcing, open innovation, open talent, the platform economy, the unintended consequences of regulation, the amazing work that NASA is doing and the problems that you're solving. And I really, really appreciate your time, Stephen. I'd like to finish, if I may, with a question we ask all of our guests. And I know you've given us a glimpse into the future at many points in our conversation. But Steve, if we can finish with this, what's your prediction, if any, for the future of work?
I personally think that there will be a kind of a reformatting of what companies are. And there'll be a core of that. But all successful organizations are going to figure out how to use some fraction, some large fraction, it's already 40%, it'll probably be larger than that soon, of this kind of contingent workforce. And that really what we're seeing is this shift of both HR and management out of, for many, many jobs and organizations, out to these platforms. And that the platforms themselves will actually have to take on the personnel development, the benefits pieces, the taking care and curating those crowds, so that they get the most benefit, because you kind of get over that Dilbert cartoon problem of owning people, and more into how do we make people the best resources possible, and how do we match them to the task at hand. And then you're going to see this creation of ecosystems of individuals and organizations, so that it's not that you won't have the same person that you're dealing with all the time. You can. But if they're sick one day or busy, you have this kind of infinite bench of others that can come in and substitute, so that the workforce itself will become more liquid. Hopefully, it will include many more innovative ways to upskill folks and really get people to where they can value add every single day, and things are interesting to them, and they're developing, and they're getting experience, and they're forming relationships, and they're, you know, addressing the balance in their life, you know, the more holistic view of things. That's my hope for it. I think AI and machine learning is going to play a big role in this, and there's going to be a joint between those, the people, the ability to form high-performing teams, the ability to connect people around well-matched teams where personality profiles are used to kind of almost like online dating has been for the dating world. Why not do that for teams, right? And get the right mix of teams. So I think it's an exciting time. I think there's still a lot to go in setting this up and morphing. So it's in a time of change. But anyone who thinks this isn't coming isn't paying attention. The old ways are quickly imploding. As we see in the work in the business lifespan. So,
well, Steve, here's to that vision of the future, and I wholeheartedly agree with what you've outlined there, Stephen. And thanks so much for taking the time to share with us and our audience your views on the future work, and also some of the challenges and problems that you've been solving for. It's been an absolutely fascinating discussion, Steve, and I just want to thank you for your time. Thanks so much. We really appreciate it, Steve. And if it's okay, where is the best place for our audience to reach out to you? Would it be LinkedIn or no?
I'm certainly on LinkedIn. You can find me at Steve Rader or LinkedIn. You can find me at nasa.gov/solve or nasa.gov/NTL. We're out there.
Love it,
Connor, Steve. This has been great. Thank you so much for having me. This has been a fun conversation.
Hey, Steve, we've really enjoyed it. And Steve, have a great day. And we'll be sure to link the YouTube video that you mentioned, Humans Need Not Apply, and also the case study you mentioned from Harvard. I think both would be fascinating watching and reading. So, Steve, take care and look forward to catching up with you soon. All the best.
Thanks, Connor.